you load it down by putting a load versus an open circuit. The frequency will move 1 part in 10 to the 6, 1 part in 10 to the 8. Very little motion of frequency, very little change in power output of that particular reference oscillator assembly that some people will call a brick. Now, I can also design a poor man's reference oscillator. I start off with a 10 megacycle crystal. I got one stage of oscillation, one stage of transistor in there that's doing the oscillation. And I've got a sampling network in there that samples some of the power output. Let me drop. And I plug that particular power output into a stage downrange. Now, because I've got so few stages of amplification, no real isolation, now as I start applying a load to that, if I'm not careful, I can kill the oscillation, I can pull the frequency a whole lot, I can do all kinds of grief. So there are oscillators and oscillators. So if your oscillator is of good enough design, where it's really intended for your particular application, it should be fairly bulletproof because it's got enough stages. If you've got enough stages of amplification after the real oscillating crystal, those stages of amplification have got lots of forward gain, lots of reverse coefficient loss. In other words, if I take a particular transistorized amplifier, which is made for 15 dB of forward gain, it may have 15 dB of reverse loss. In other words, the signal that flows forward is 15 dB greater than what was applied to it. The signal gets applied in the reverse direction is going to be 15 dB weaker instead of gain. It's got all kinds of isolation. And if I got two or three of those stages downrange after the oscillator, it becomes pretty bulletproof. Whatever I do to the load doesn't matter. The crystal doesn't see the difference. So are you running a bare crystal oscillator where the oscillator stage is the output, or are there enough stages of amplification in between? And if your particular oscillator is not bulletproof enough, you can add stages of amplification to make it more bulletproof. And how do you properly impedance match so that the signal is working correctly? There's a whole art and science to making sure that your particular output stage, your sampling port on your crystal oscillator, is sampling a small enough signal that's being applied to the next stage of amplification that you're getting the desirable gain without loading down that crystal oscillator. As I said, there's a whole op-
repeater. Time out.
There's a whole art and science, a learning curve, to how you properly interface multiple stages of an amplification string in, let's say, an oscillator assembly. So there is no simple answer to this. However, impedance matching is part of it. Enough isolation is part of it. Don't overload the oscillator. Every quartz crystal oscillator, for instance, has a particular power amplitude at which the quartz works correctly. You don't want to overpower the quartz, otherwise you'll fracture it. You don't want to underpower it, otherwise it becomes too vulnerable to pulling and killing the oscillation. And then how you sample the power out of the oscillator stage and put it into the next amplification stage, that's something that's worthy of study. And if you properly choose the right words and you Google those words on the internet, you will get answers to this. And it's not simply saying that make sure you're using a 1K resistor. In some cases, that can do it. If you're sampling the port out of the oscillator by coupling to the next stage through a 1 kilo-ohm resistor, that gives you isolation. It's a rather light load on the oscillator stage, but it might give you enough signal into the next stage to keep the next stage happy. And then the whole thing works after that. It could be as simple as a 1K resistor in some cases. KC2WGB, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, the amplifier that he's using is a 20 dB amplifier, and it can handle up to 100 meg from, I think, 1 meg, 1 to 100 meg. And he did not tell me what the input impedance of that amplifier is. Now, it might be 50 ohms, or it could be a 10K input. I'm not sure, but maybe I'll dash him off a note, or maybe he's listening, he'll send me something and let me know what that is, and maybe we can carry it on further. Okay, but I would also tell him to look at the original diagram of the HP equipment he took that oscillator out of, and there may be a network in there that he could use to do the coupling he's interested in. Just another way of looking at it. KC2WGB. I think it's time to go over to Paul. Getting late. And let's hear the space report. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, John. John, you were speaking quite softly during that last transmission. We heard everything you said. But you were a little bit lower in volume than I think you should be. That's an opinion. And the network that you set up with resistors, inductors, and capacitors that does interstage coupling, that couples the desired signal and doesn't couple undesired signals, and gives you the right impedance match in and out, that's a whole art and science that's worth learning. LRC networks that do impedance matching and coupling of the desired frequencies. And is it a filter? Is it an impedance matcher? Is it an anti-loading circuit? Properly done, it's all of the above. So, the January issue, I'm going over to Paul now, WS2N. Paul, the January issue of Astronomy Magazine, which I saw in my local library this week. Let me drop it. Has a very nice article entitled, What Are the Most 10 Significant Things That Happened, Astronomically Speaking, During the Year of 2013. Very nice article in Astronomy Magazine, January 2014 issue. I'll go get that list. I wrote down a list of the things. One of them, of course, the number one thing was the meteorite that struck Russia a few months ago, and all of the damage that it created. That was one of the astronomical events of this year that was quite significant, and there were quite a few others. So over to you, Paul, and how is that piece of electronics on Mars doing? Correction, on the Moon. WS2N, our space expert, K2LIW in the TechNet.
This is WS2N. Well, the Jade Rabbit is still riding around, that 308-pound thing. It's still riding around on its six wheels. I understand it's doing good. It'll stay operational, I guess, until it gets dark up there. And then I'm sure they'll go into a shutdown period for 2 weeks. And they'll keep the system hot with the uranium-238 they have on board. That and the lander. The lander is operational. In fact, the lander has a telescope on board. I'm sure it's useless now in the daylight. But when it gets dark, it has, that will definitely be operational. They're going to point it to the center of the galaxy and see what it looks like from the moon. So can't get a clearer sky than that, that's for sure. So we'll see what happens with that. But I wanted to talk about something a little closer to the Earth, and that's the NH3 problem, the ammonia pump problem on the ISS. A while back, I believe it was on the 11th, they discovered a problem that we talked about a little bit last week. The ammonia was not pumping properly, therefore not cooling down the starboard side of the radiators that they have hooked up. So there's a starboard side radiator system with a pump arrangement, you know, for ammonia, and they have one on the port side as well. So the starboard side failed. This happened about 3 years ago, too, around 2010. They changed out this unit, and now it seems to be another problem with it. One of the valves that are not working properly. We discussed whether or not it was pneumatic or not. It's electrical. I found that out by looking at the closest diagrams of this thing. So apparently it's not that's not operating properly. We drop it. Now they can't just open up the box, reach in, find this valve. This pump assembly is in a box, looks bigger than a refrigerator. and it, all the system weighs a little less than 800 pounds. So, got quite a bit in there. If you would open it up, there's another box with a pump, and inside of that pump, the box is valves that operate open, close, half open, half closed. And then there's all kinds of electronics that controls this. There's an accumulator with extra ammonia inside to, in case there's a slight leak, it can make up for that. The accumulator is kind of like an expansion situation. If the ammonia expands or contracts, the accumulator makes up for that. Then it does have a nitrogen backing to it. So now, apparently this unit is giving them trouble. So the idea is to remove it. So yesterday, they sent two astronauts out. Mike Hopkins went outside to actually remove this thing. It's quite a bit involved to removing a unit this size. It's located in the S1 truss section, so they go out to Quest Lab, and once they get over to it, one guy's attached to the robotic arm that's a
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And bringing Rick in as close as possible to the refrigerator, as I'm going to call it that. And they've got to disconnect it. To disconnect this thing, they've got a 4.5-inch diameter line, so they're large lines with quick disconnects on them, as well as a 1/2-inch ammonia line as well. So these are a roll of ammonia lines, and it's a little different than the handle is a little different than your typical ball valve. Your ball valve that you would normally throw open and close has one handle, and it operates the valve, there's one metal piece that turns it. These are a little fancier. They have two pieces, one on one side, one on the other, so you're able to grab it almost a little D-ring and push it, and in doing that you're closing off the valve and disconnecting it from the unit. With that disconnect, those four lines, there's electrical connections, five electrical connections, and if you look at it close, they have like little disconnect type things too. You don't have to unscrew them. So you can pull on those, they will disconnect. And then toward the back, they have these 5/8-inch diameter bolts that they have to unscrew. And that holds this whole unit in. So you got an idea of how well this thing is all assembled. They just 5/8 diameter bolts for them to hold this contraption to the S1 truss section. So they have to disconnect it. They pulled it all out. One guy pulls it out. He's attached to the robotic arm. And then they have to bring up a grapple type of fixture attached to it. It's adjustable, a grapple fixture. Once that's attached to it, they have a place that they can fasten it to somewhere. So they have another thing that they attach it to called a TOA. And they love to use all these acronyms, but it's just an area that this grapple of fixture will attach to. It's called the Payload Orbital Replacement Unit Accommodation, so it's a piece that's sticking off the side of the truss, and they can attach it to it, and have a place to put their pump module. Now the next step is going to be another spacewalk, not Monday, but Tuesday. to get a new one, which is attached to the ESP3, an external stowage platform that they have. They have these external stowage platforms all over the ISS, about a half a dozen of them. And on ESP3, they have a spare pump. So it's again attached to the robotic arm, and it's about 50 feet away, almost all the way to the truss section 4, where it's located. And disconnect that, they have to unbolt it, same 4 bolts, 5/8-inch bolts, and then bring it over and reinstall that, hook up all these inch-and-a-half lines and electrical lines, and once they do all that, they'll eventually have to cover it with the Mylar blankets, you know, for insulation, and then they'll be able to turn it on, and they'll be able to use the, they're going to keep the old one stored on the, probably back into the ESP, the external storage platform, where the other one came out, and leave it there until a future time where they might be able to do something with it and eventually get that valve or whatever the problem is, maybe a controller. There's controllers that control these valves, and that might be a problem too, and that's all inside that box. So it's a lot of work planned, a lot more to it than I've described here. It's pretty much an overview of the situation. They've got to remove this gigantic refrigerator, 800-pound thing, and replace it with another one. So that's the goal. They want to do the other spacewalk on Monday, but they have to wait till Tuesday because Rick has a problem with his spacesuit, and they need to reconfigure another spacesuit that's on board the ISS to his body size to get him to go out. That's going to take a little while, so that's delayed till Tuesday. Because of that, there was a third planned spacewalk that they'll probably have to do, and that was going to be on Christmas. That will be the day after Christmas now to see if this all works. Let me drop it. Only other thing I want to talk about was Curiosity is back up and running. That did have a problem in the middle of the month as well. Some kind of a software type of problem. But since then, they have sent up a new program, a completely new program to Curiosity. But it does take a long time, about a week to send that program up. And that gives them more storage space for memory. They'll be able to use the robotic arm a little bit better on slopes. They find different ways to do things, improve systems, and they send it up to the rover all the time. It's about the third time they've done it since over a year that it's been riding around on Mars. So that thing's doing well. The main thing I've been following, of course, is the this whole ammonia system, how it works, trying to get as much information on it as possible. Apparently, it's a big problem here. They have to shut down 3 of the modules, drop it. The module, which is run by Japan, they have to cut back on that. They have to cut back on the Columbus module. Just can't run all the experiments that they want to do because everything goes off key. That's the problem. They have to get rid of the heat inside the ISS. The Russian portion of the ISS has its own pump systems, radiometers, and all this. The American side is the one with the problems right now. We'll see how they do in a couple of days. By the next net, we should know if everything got back up and running. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
International Space Station and these spacewalks that they were doing. I'm looking now at the news report of July 16th, 2013, when astronaut Luca Pomateno was the man who had somewhere between 1 and 5 liters of water leaked into the breathable atmosphere inside of his suit. An awful lot of it was in the helmet. And whether that came from the water that's part of the cooling system, that's the garment that he wears, or whether it's the 32-ounce water bag that's on board so he can have drinkable water, one of those leaked. Ordinarily on Earth, you're wearing a suit of some kind. Like say, for instance, you're wearing a scuba suit. You're underwater, but you're in the vicinity of gravity, and you can predict exactly where the water's going to go. If you're standing upright, the water is going to gather at the feet of your suit. But when you're in space and there is no gravity, you're in microgravity, the water can drift around and go anywhere it wants. So as you get these globs of water drifting around in free space in your helmet, it can drown you. So it's a very dangerous condition, and I think I saw on a news report tonight, let me drop it, that on this most recent space report, spacewalk, they did as much checking as they can to make sure there are no water leaks in the suit, but just in case, they also gave him a breathing tube, which he can use if he runs into the problem. And I'd like to believe that this is a fairly rare situation, but an awful dangerous situation. If you get globs of water drifting around in your helmet when you're in weightlessness, and if it happens to drift in front of your nose while you're inhaling, you could set up a pretty nasty situation. So I wonder if some recent news along those lines has come along now, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW and the Tech Man.
Yes, it has, Dick. And yeah, Louis, he had a nice interview, talked about his family and the dangers of going on space. Say he was on that spacewalk, you know, out of trouble. They found out how much trouble later on after he was in, and we started really telling the story of the stuff getting into his nose, mouth, eyes. He couldn't see. Couldn't see which way he was going, trying to get back to the lab, Quest lab. Not easy. Not an easy situation. They found out, there's all kinds of tubing with inside the spacesuit. It wasn't that leaking. They go around. You have a garment on it. That garment has all the tubing on it, and the space goes over that. That garment was not leaking. What happens is, when you inhale and exhale, there's moisture builds up. Sweat, whatever. Now there's this water. This moisture is supposed to be being sucked into one area toward the bottom of the suit, and they have filters on there and all, and moisture is supposed to go to one side. They separate it somehow, and then the carbon dioxide goes to the other side. And this recirculating system has a discharge, and the discharge comes out behind his head. Instead of just having a bunch of holes there, there's a plate there behind his head, and it comes up behind that plate and rises above his head, and that's how the air comes into the air, for him to breathe. Drive it. So this filter unit got clogged up where it wasn't taking that humidity, the moisture that you normally find in air. And it was staying in the suit, getting recirculated with the other air, and coming up behind his head. Quickly, a matter of time, next thing he had, it was like almost like a half a liter of water floating around his face. So that's what I've heard on that thing. And they've got it pretty much figured out. To take no chances yet, they call them snorkels. They each got a snorkel to arrive inside the space suit with them. On the last EVA on Saturday. Dick.
Sounds good. I'm kind of curious as to why this never happened before. What was different about this particular mission at this particular spacewalk? It sounds like a unique situation to me, Paul. And I guess you said it was a failure of that, if I understand correctly, the mechanism that is supposed to absorb the moisture that you breathe out. And when a person, for instance, is in the Arctic or the Arctic, the air that he's breathing, the super cold, super dry air, your nasal passages, your trachea, your body has to take each one of those breaths, put in the right amount of moisture and the right amount of heat. That air that arrives in your lungs has got to be close to 98 degrees Fahrenheit at close to the right humidity. Otherwise, your breathing mechanism won't work very well for very long. So your body has to make a significant investment in the cold air that you breathe. And depending on how cold it is, that could be a problem. In the case of space, the air that you're breathing out, your body has put moisture into that air. So you're continuously breathing out a certain amount of moisture with the air that you just breathed in and breathed out. So I guess you're saying there's a desiccating-like system that has to collect that moisture and keep it away from everything else in the breathable air inside that suit. So, to your knowledge, was that the failure mechanism of that water-absorbing system, has that been identified so that they're fairly sure it can't happen again? And I guess they're a little worried that it could happen again with the current design. That's the reason why they supplied those snorkels to those two space-walking astronauts. What's your guesses on my part? Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW, and the Tech Man.
Yeah, they said they know the filter. They just don't know why. They're dealing with, for instance, this spacesuit is designed at 30 years old. And there's going to be a lot of improvements. Newer suits that are coming out, and it's really an upgrade. You know, each upgrade over as the years go by, they improve the suits, but it's still based on a 30-year-old design, and they've never had a problem with that part of the system. So you don't know why that clogged up. You don't know how what came about. Hopkins actually wore the same suit that Lewis wore, and they ask him every now and then, you know, basically, how you doing, you know, any water in there, you know, and a lot of it comes from sweating, especially if you're, you know, time goes on, you're getting worse, and here's a couple of drops coming by, and you start thinking about it, you start giving off moisture. Eugene Cernan, they said that he lost 10 pounds of moisture, of sweat, when he was in a Gemini 10 or something. He was doing a spacewalk, trying to perfect the spacewalk system. And when he was supposed to get to the back of the Gemini and put on a backpack and drop it. And they figured out not only did his heart rate, blood pressure shoot way up, but his, he lost about 10 pounds of water trying to. Like in a panic, trying to get back to the Gemini spacecraft. The water all wound up in his feet. Got absorbed in all of the clothes that he had on, but they figured out that he sweated out that much inside of a couple of hours. So that moisture has to go somewhere, and it wasn't getting to where it was going. And I still haven't figured out exactly. I guess they don't know. I haven't read a report on what went wrong with the filtering device. We drop it. That's pretty much it. I mean, heat and everything with the space station. It's a big problem trying to get rid of heat. But bodies, space station, even the ammonia system, it's not even an evaporation system. It's not an evaporation condenser ammonia system. You know, like we had in the old houses with the, back in the 30s, you know, you had actual ammonia systems running refrigerators before Freon came out. I mean, they're using ammonia to circulate the get the heat out of the space station. I mean, if they were going to really use the ammonia in a way, you know, in a refrigeration type of way, they could use a lot less, but they can't. I think it's something like 400 BTUs per pound and, for ammonia or something like that. But they're just using it as a circulating system. Just, you know, you get heat from one place to another. So they can't use water, so they're using ammonia. So, big problem, space boots, space suits, people inside the space station trying to keep cool. He really builds up in that thing. Back to you, Dave.
A human being in normal conscious sitting in a chair is dissipating heat at the rate of 450 BTUs per hour, roughly 130 watts. The amount of heat coming off a 130 watt incandescent light bulb is the amount of heat continuously coming off your body because you're metabolizing food. Your body, in order to carry on all of its biological processes, is metabolizing food, breathing air, the oxygen of the food, the oxygen of the air mixes with the food, and does something that's desirable chemically, but is giving off heat. Most of these are exothermic reactions. So you're a 130 watt heat generator. And that space suit has to dissipate 130 watts continuously. And if something goes wrong where the temperature inside the suit, you'd like it to be 70 degrees Fahrenheit, and it climbs up to 90 degrees Fahrenheit, your body is going to respond by sweating. Because that's the usual way on Earth by which it does cooling, evaporative cooling. In order to keep you from going above, let me pick the number, 105 degrees Fahrenheit. As you go above 105 or 106 degrees Fahrenheit, you're getting dangerously close to a temperature in which brain material will be damaged. Let me drop. So your body has got a very fancy cooling system. And think about if you're walking through a desert environment where the air might be 110 degrees Fahrenheit. And under normal circumstances, you're turning out 130 watts of heat. You're in an environment of 110 Fahrenheit. And if by some means, by continuous water being evaporated off your body, if you're not able to keep your body below that outside temperature, below, let me pick a number, 105 degrees Fahrenheit, then you're game over. You have to be dissipating, evaporating a certain amount of water from your body continuously. You can't just sit yourself in front of a fan if the outside temperature is 105. It's trying to get you up to 105. You've got to be evaporating. You've got to be doing something. And obviously, how much water is in your body in that environment? How long can you be evaporating water at a fast enough rate to keep your body below the outside temperature? Something to very seriously consider. There are people who forget about some of these details. Let me drop. And heat itself is a funny substance. There was a report I read this week about the Voyager spacecraft. There has been a 35-year mystery about Voyager. The nice thing about the deep space network of NASA is that it can very accurately, 2 inches, measure the rate and distance between, let's say, the Goldstone dish and the Voyager spacecraft. The way that system works with its phase locking, it can very precisely measure slant range distance and range rate. And so for 35 years, they have recognized that Voyager is slowing down a little bit faster than it should. You launch a spacecraft away from the Earth, and you think it's going to go to Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. That's what Voyager do. It did a slingshot effect with almost all of those planets. You think you're in a space mission between those planets. That's a naive way of looking at it. Let me drop. Once you've left the vicinity of Earth and Earth's gravity, that spacecraft is an object in orbit around the sun. It is a solar system object. They knew exactly how much gravity the sun makes. So during the time it's on interplanetary transition, where it's far away from either planet, it's continuously being pulled back by the sun, they expected it to slow down at a certain rate. And it was slowing down at a slightly higher rate. A continuous offset. And as they looked deeper and deeper into it, they couldn't figure out what's going on. And what this report I read this week was that somebody funded a study where they collected all of the old data. Some of those data tapes were in cardboard boxes under a staircase at NASA. Some of them were about to be thrown out, and somebody decided that it's too valuable, so he took those boxes of tapes home and kept them in his garage. They collected all these tapes and combed through them, looking for the missing ingredient. Why was Voyager slowing down faster than it was supposed to? Really deep mystery. Kept them going for a long time. The answer is strange. Let me drop. At first they thought all the heat being given off by the nuclear generators, the electric power generators, would be reflecting off of the dish and creating a kind of thrust. Well, those nuclear power generators are on very long arms way outside of the vicinity of the dish to keep the nuclear radiation away from the experiments, which could damage them. What the final answer was is kind of strange. You're pouring continuously a couple of hundred watts of electrical power into Voyager in order to run its cameras, in order to run its inertial wheels, in order to run motors and actuators and whatever. You're doing all kinds of things with that electrical power. But if you look at the spacecraft package, which is all packed behind the dish, it is an object that's getting 100 or 200 watts of electrical power continuously pumped into it. And what's it doing with that? It's not pushing on anything in the outside universe. From a black box point of view, it is doing no external work. Every one of those watts, every one of those watt seconds or joules of energy you're pouring into that package has to be dissipated into space as heat. There's no choice. Because that whole package sits behind the dish, and the dish is a, thermally speaking, reflective object. Let me drop. And 99.9% of the time, that dish is always aimed exactly at Earth so that the deep space network can communicate with that thing. That's 120 astronomical units out there, three times the distance of Pluto. It's got to communicate with Earth. It's got to aim the dish at Earth. And from a Voyager point of view, Earth is a tiny little dot close to the sun. So you could say that that dish is almost aimed at the sun. And all the heat being given off by that package hits the back of the dish, gets re-reflected out into space away from sun. The thermal energy radiated by that package, reflecting off the dish, represents an extremely small amount of thrust, a little bit like an ionic engine, but it's continuous. It took place for 35 solid years, and that was the answer. The thermal emission of the package reflected off the dish made a minor amount of thrust pushing the Voyager spacecraft toward the sun that slowed down, that slightly speeded up the rate at which it decelerated as it moved away from the sun. And there's a beautiful report explaining all of this. Who would ever have thought that heat given off at 70 degrees Fahrenheit is a thrusting object? You do it for 35 solid years, it accumulates. Wonder if you heard about that one, Paul. WS2N, KQRIW, and the TechNet.
I haven't seen that report yet. Interesting. Very good. In the beginning, I was starting to think, it started to sound like the theory of putting a fan on the boat and having the fan blow the sail and you're going to go forward. You're not going to go anywhere.
Yes and no. It depends on where the air goes after it deflects off that sun, after that sail, after it reflects off that sail. It may give you a sidewise thrust, but yes. That's sort of the bootstrap problem. You're not going to lift yourself up in the air by pulling onto your bootstraps, as they used to say. You're pulling and pushing a sort of balance as well. The heat being radiated by Voyager is a non-balanced force. And these 10 items that were in the January 2014 issue of Astronomy Magazine, the most significant 10 events that occurred in the year 2013. Number one was the Chelyabinsk meteor, 440 kilotons of TNT equivalent. In other words, that's 10 times bigger than the Hiroshima bomb, was the amount of energy dissipated by that meteor that hit Russia. That was number one. Number two item was the they discovered that the cosmic rays are made by supernovas. As a supernova is formed, it accelerates material and creates the cosmic rays. Number three is the most significant. I'm reading them in reverse order, so to speak. Most significant first. Cosmic microwave background has a new picture that was done by the European Space Agency, which adds to the picture that was done by the, why can't I think of the cosmic microwave background measurer?
WMAP.
The Wilkinson Anisotropy Probe. WMAP. Williams Microwave Anisotropy Probe. That was the second one. There was a cosmic microwave background explorer, the WMAP, and now the new Planck device by European Space Agency. So we're getting more and more fine details. More and more.
Repeater, time out.
More and more microkelvins of resolution of the thermal background. And that's helping us figure out what really happened in the Big Bang. The Curiosity is discovering more and more evidence that Mars was once a habitable environment. Comets are snow, dirty snowballs. Let's see. Kepler suffered a kind of a death. That was the spacecraft that was looking for extrasolar planets. Our own black hole, they're discovering more about it, the one that's in the center of our galaxy. A great big gas cloud was recently eaten up by that supermassive black hole that's in the center of our galaxy, and they're now observing the distortion of that gas cloud as it gets closer and closer to that black hole and orbits around it. They're resolving some of the Van Allen belt mysteries, and they're discovering there's more than just the two belts they knew about. And where's the energy from those Van Allen belts coming from? Let me drop. Item number nine is Voyager is now officially in interstellar space. It has left the solar environment, the solar system. And they're discovering some of the mechanism by which a black hole can create these jets of material at near the speed of light that exit from the North Pole and the South Pole of a black hole. So, good issue. When it comes to astronomical information intended for the general public, the three best magazines I know of are Sky and Telescope, Astronomy, and Scientific American. For readable by the general public, yeah. The astronomical journals that are written in high-tech language, they go deeper, but they're not very readable. Let me drop. And so about 150 years worth of Sky and Telescope magazines exist every single month. And Astronomy Magazine is starting to give them some serious competition as I see it. Very readable material. Now, John did an experiment this week, which he's going to, if he wants to, describe a little bit of it. And I did a similar experiment at Edwards Air Force Base for a very good reason. Back in 1989 and 1990, I had the huge resources of the world's largest anechoic chamber, the Benningfield Anechoic Chamber, which is 1.5 acres, a chamber 7 stories high, thoroughly shielded by 100 dB. And you put a whole full-size B-1 bomber inside that chamber, put it on that rotating table, which is rotated with 16 railroad car wheel system. You're putting a quarter of a million pound airplane on a turntable that's 85 feet in diameter and rotating it while aiming signals at the airplane inside this anechoic chamber. And so I was involved in an experiment that used that equipment, but John didn't know about my experiment, I don't think, and he was doing a similar experiment in Richmond County, where he lives, Staten Island. So, if that's the subject you would like to talk about, if there's two subjects that we discussed on the phone today, both of them darn interesting, choose the one you want to talk about, John. because I think we've got some time now to do it. And as a radio experiment that can be done with quasi-ham radio equipment, it can turn into a real fun thing. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick, I think I'll pick the scalar experiment first, because I watched that video that Wesley had sent out, and I thought you might have some comments on it. He claims that this is proven technology, and it proves that scalar waves exist and that power can be transmitted on. You know, sounds kind of hokey, but the guy has a little kit you can buy for, I think it's under $1,000. So if you can, I'd like to talk about that one.
Yeah, that does sound like a good one. One of the issues in the last 6 months or so of the QST magazine for experimenters, all of a sudden I can't think of the name of the darn thing. I get it every 2 months or so. It showed an experiment where a person set up this unusual kind of a feed horn, and he believes he was transmitting scalar waves. And in both the experiment you're about to describe and the experiment that was described in QTC, I think it is, magazine, Experiments in Exchange, you've got to be careful, because this is one of those situations where after you've done the experiment, you've gotten the results, and you think the results confirm what you believe, that a scalar wave was transmitted and a scalar wave was received. Because this is such an unusual claim, let me drop it. Compared to all the history of radio, I mean, if I want to decide that when Maxwell wrote his equations and Marconi did his experiments and that radio got rolling in 1840, I could make an assumption like that, that we started using wireless techniques and radio transmitting and receiving around 1840, 1850. That makes it what? 170 years ago, 160 years ago, something in that order. So radio has been around for 170 years. We've got 170 years of history of what we call radio being a transverse electromagnetic wave, TEM, transverse electromagnetic wave. That means the transmitted wave has an E field and an H field that are both at right angles to each other and both at right angles to the direction of propagation. Everybody accepts that. We've got 170 years of history of it. And from time to time, recently, people come along saying, I've got this brand new wave that transmits, a radio wave, and it's not transverse electromagnetic. It's this thing, this other kind of wave. And if you're a real good scientist, you've got to make every possible measurement you can think of, and all your friends can think of, and all the institutions can think of, to confirm that it's not a false alarm. And I'll give you one example. Let me drop. I'm running my microwave dish. I've got a 12-foot diameter dish, and I did build one, 12-foot diameter. August 1972 QST magazine. You can look at it on the front cover. And if I'm using that dish at 1296 megacycles, I've got a feed horn in front of the dish at 1296 megacycles. Assume that my dish is covered with the most beautiful conductive metal in the world, 12-foot diameter parabolic dish, and I got a feed horn in front of it that's transmitting a signal at 1296. And I stand directly behind that dish, right in the middle behind it, in the complete shadow of the dish. Good common sense would tell you that the signal I measured there would be nothing. You do that experiment, you'll find out the signal there is 25-30 dB weaker than the signal coming out of the horn. But there's a significant signal back there. It's 70 dB above threshold of a normal receiver. That's a lot of signal, even though it's attenuated by 30 dB by the dish. Some of that signal crawls around the edge of the dish and it gets there. It's a proof positive of one of those statements that I say all the time. You launch a radio wave, it goes to every cubic centimeter of this universe. You can't stop it from doing that. It's going to be stronger and weaker in various areas. It will go everywhere. And the only thing left to discuss is it above threshold of the equipment you're using at this time at that location? Let me drop. So once you realize that the signal goes everywhere, and you launch this new signal that you call a transverse wave, I mean a longitudinal wave, or give it a scalar wave, give it any words you want. Longitudinal is one of the words that's used. And you make a measurement. And you say, hey, I set up my equipment to measure longitudinal waves. And I think that my measurement is rejecting transverse electromagnetic waves so that I'm not being fooled. Okay. My next question is, your rejection mechanism of transverse electromagnetic waves, how many dB of rejection have you got? If you've got 30 dB of rejection, you're in trouble. Because what you think is a longitudinal wave could really be a transverse electromagnetic wave that's sneaking past your TEM filter. Until you can prove that you've got, let me pick a number, 130 decibels of rejection of TEM, and now what you left over and you measured, you think is longitudinal or scalar. Maybe. But boy, you're fighting, as I said, 170 years of history that you think you've got a brand new kind of wave. And why has it taken 170 years for that to be discovered? You can see there's a lot of questions here. So tell me what your impression was when you saw the video, John. And do you believe that you saw enough parallel measurements that can reject to a high degree the alternate explanation, if you know what I mean? KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. No, I don't believe he proved scalar waves existed. Although the experiment was interesting in the way he presented it, let me describe the construct and what he did, and then you can take it and maybe you can describe what was happening. Just let me let it drop. He has two stainless steel balls, approximately 5 inches in diameter. They're suspended about a foot above the table on these plastic rods. Okay. One is the transmit element, one is a receiver. Okay. When he transmits a 4 megahertz signal, I believe it was 4 megahertz, the receiver would pick it up and a light would come on. If he took his hand and put it near the receiving antenna, that ball, in between the transmitting antenna and the receiving ball, just put his hand there, the signal would stop. The light would go out. What he did next was he retuned the oscillator, found a second resonant point at 7 megahertz, roughly, 7.2 it may have been. Now when he puts his hand in front of the receiving ball or the receiving antenna, it doesn't stop. That's what he claims is the elongation of the near-field radiation, which allows the scalar wave to travel, and he can't block it.
Okay, there's many things going on here simultaneously as I see it, John. When it comes to making antenna range measurements, you've got the world's best antenna range, you've got an antenna under test, and you put it on this range. If you're smart enough, you'll calculate three things. Where's the far field, where's the near field, where's the reactive near field? And there's a formula you can plug in when you know the dimensions and the frequencies of your antenna where you can calculate where you are, where you're making your measurement. Your sensing antenna and your antenna under test are some distance apart. They're either the far field, near field, or reactive near field. Let's talk about the reactive near field. The word reactive near field is called that for about 2, 3, 4 reasons. When you're that close to an antenna and you try to make a measurement that you think is going to follow the inverse square law, under normal circumstances, at normal range where you really use an antenna, let me drop. At normal range in the far field, every time you double the distance from an antenna, the signal you pick up will be 6.02 dB weaker, one quarter the power. That's the inverse square law. As you start getting into the near field and reactive near field, it no longer obeys inverse square law. Signal strength versus distance starts bearing a law that looks like cube, fourth, fifth, sixth power. As you start getting very close to the antenna, you start picking up all kinds of increased signal strength. And what is that really? If you're close enough to the antenna, you think you're transmitting a wave, you think you're picking up that wave that's being transmitted. In reality, the capacitive coupling between your so-called transmitting structure and your receiving structure, the capacitive coupling eventually dominates when you get close. The inductive coupling starts dominating. The apparent impedance starts doing funny things. So your sensing antenna develops a brand new impedance. It may not be impedance matched anymore to your receiving equipment. You're getting capacitive coupling effects, inductive coupling effects, and the inverse square law, in other words, to the second power, starts acting like it's to the third, fourth, fifth, and sixth power. That is a very well-known phenomena of being inside of that close range called reactive near field. So the fact that I can choose a frequency with close space antennas, and by the way, at 4 megahertz, where the wavelength is something in the vicinity of 70 meters, and I've got these two antennas that are inches or feet apart.
About 3 feet apart.
Yeah, 3 feet is, let me drop this. 3 feet is such a small distance compared to the wavelength of 80 meters, 70 meters. It's a 210 feet is the wavelength, and I'm a couple of feet apart. I'm way inside the reactive near field of those antennas. So I'm getting capacitive coupling effects. And you put your hand there, and you think your hand is a shield. Not at all. At 4 megacycles, your hand is a capacitive blob of water, which is not a shield. It's a disturbing device. Water has got a dielectric constant of 81, and the medium becomes something very different with your hand there. But if that great big 12-foot diameter metallic object, called my 12-foot parabolic dish, if that wasn't a shield, obvious by the fact I can stand directly behind that dish and pick up a significant amount of signal, 70 decibels stronger than the threshold of my receiver, in what I thought was the black, thoroughly shielded back end of the antenna, thoroughly blocked signal. Your mind would tell you you're in a thoroughly blocked area. Mm-hmm. That's not what the radio wave says. It finds a way of sneaking in there. So it's very difficult now from what you've described so far, John, to make a judgment as to whether or not that is a confirmation of some other method of propagation. You're in the very, very close near field. You're getting signals reflecting off of the floor, the walls, the rest of your body, and all of those zillions of paths between the transmitting sphere and the receiving sphere, all of those paths are there simultaneously. And by step-by-step procedures, let me drop. By step-by-step procedures, it is possible to quantify the amount of signal by each one of those propagating phenomena. But there's a lot of phenomena here. This was not done in an anechoic chamber. This was not done in a shielded environment. And therefore, making judgment in this situation is kind of difficult. KC2WGB, make sure you're giving us some audio, John. K2RIW and the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, I hope this is better. I got a little closer to the mic. I believe I'm representing his experiment the way I saw it. I don't think I've left out anything. But if Wesley's listening, and he may want to mention something that may expand it, let's see if he's out there. And 2XJN, KC2WGB, TechNet. Unfortunately, I guess he's not with us. But, yeah, that's what I saw, Dick. And I didn't think that was proof positive of anything. But the difference between the 7 megahertz and the 4 megahertz with his hand, where it would block it at 4, but not at 7. Now, maybe that's because of the positioning. If he would have extended it maybe another 3 feet or closer, maybe it would have made a difference.
Yeah, it turns out the word blocking is a very relativistic word, John. I worked on arguably one of the world's best anechoic chambers way back in 1989, 1990 at Edwards Air Force Base, the Benny Field Anechoic Facility. This chamber was a $60 million construction. The work was done by Rockwell International, paid for by the Air Force with a great big contract. And this chamber consisted of steel walls, eighth of an inch thick, great big panels of steel, All the steel panels were carefully welded together